This is a London Undone podcast. My name is Catherine Cartwright. These podcasts give you an audible insight into some curious places around London. This series focuses on the historic and at times peculiar City of London churches, their histories, features, associations, and their spiritual lives. For this podcast, we go to St. Catherine Cree. Here, I talk to Judy Stevenson, who's a church watcher for the Friends of the City Churches, and Brian Grumbridge, who is their resident historian. The podcast is really in two parts, the first being about the church, and the second tells the sad story of the Lancastria. Now, the Lancastria was a ship that was sunk in 1940, trying to save Allied troops after the fall of Dunkirk in the Second World War. Fast forward to 20 minutes if that's what's more interesting to you. There's a memorial window in the church to this tragic event, and I spoke to families connected with the tragedy of the Lancastria at the annual service that takes place there. They are Roger Round and Martin Coops.
The name Catherine Cree, you'll notice that it's Catherine with a K and Cree, C-R-E-E. And so the church is dedicated to St. Catherine, she who was martyred on a Catherine wheel. Cree is an alternative of Christ. And the street outside is called Cree Church Lane.
We're very close to Aldgate, which was the old gate on the east side of London. And, I mean, the background to this church was that when travellers, I suppose they were, came in through Aldgate, they would immediately enter from about the early 12th century onwards into what was the Holy Trinity Priory of Aldgate, which occupied all the sort of land you can see here, right up to sort of Aldgate Station.
Yeah.
All that whole area, all where the old gate was. And in the 13th century, the prior of Holy Trinity Aldgate got a bit fed up with all these local people coming in and disrupting his services with his canons, that he agreed that they could have their own church built in the grounds of Holy Trinity Priory. And so at the end of the 13th century, the first St. Catherine Cree was built. So that's when St. Catherine Cree originally came into being, in about 1290, 1300-ish.
So he essentially wanted to keep all the riffraff out.
Indeed.
Out of the way. Yes.
I'm not sure whether it was their singing he didn't like or whether they spoke during the services.
So rather than driving them out,
he gave them their own church. The priory was founded in 1108 by Matilda, who was Henry I's consort.
Yeah.
And John Stripe, who wrote about the area of the City of London, he says Norman took on him to be prior of Christ Church in the year of Christ 1108. And so it was Norman who was the prior here. And then a later prior decided to build the Church of St. Catherine Cree for the sole use of the parishioners in order to prevent his canons being disturbed by the laity. And the priory itself was extremely wealthy.
And it went the way of all monastic...
It was the first one to go. It was the first to be dissolved in 1531.
Right.
And it's Henry VIII gave the priory, including St. Catherine Cree, to Sir Thomas Audley, who later bequeathed it to Magdalene College, Cambridge.
Right. So it was
under their control for a period of time. They did eventually give it up. The original, or the second church, was pulled down in the 1620s. There has been a church on this site for a long time.
And this particular church we're sitting in, how far back can we date this to?
We can date this exactly. On the top of a column there, I don't know whether you want to
stop and have a look. Let's have a look at it.
There you can see on that arch, the 1630.
Yes, you can. So that dates the building that we're in, which makes it a pre-fire church.
Yes.
So essentially we're looking by the entrance, pretty much.
Yep.
At the back, on the back wall, there's this column, which is sort of
hip
height for me anyway.
Yeah. And that's the top of the original, well, second church, I think it was, on the site. And Leadenhall Street, over time, was raised, and Cree Church Lane. And so you had to go down steps to get into this church in the 1600s, early 1600s. So when the church fell into decay, they actually raised the level of the of where the church, this church, was built.
So there's a little piece of the church that stood here before this one.
Yes, it's the only bit. Well, I say it's the only bit. There are one or two monuments that are obviously pre-1630.
The church survived the Great Fire of London of 1666. During the 18th century, however, the church began to decay and the foundations found to be not too good. There was fear that it was going to be pulled down and destroyed. However, the funds were found and it is now safe, you'll be pleased to know.
It survived the Great Fire. It survived the Second World War nearly intact. A couple of the windows were damaged and the south wall was damaged. There was also some damage, but not a great deal, when the IRA bomb went off
just around the corner.
The shape of the church is as it was before the Great Fire. You've got the two aisles, and it's wonderful that you can now see it as a whole church, because for a long time after the war, the church was used as offices, and there were offices between each of the columns going back to the windows. I want to show you a really exciting piece, which you might just miss if you were here on your own. This is clearly the remains of the original churchyard.
Well, we've come into the garden of the church, or what used to be the churchyard.
And this used to be the main entrance into this garden, presumably from the street.
So it's a lovely stone gateway, really.
And you have got, in the pediment above the gateway, a memento mori, where you have got a draped female form, but she has a skull instead of a face, and hands and ribs. I think this one is much less gruesome than many of them. You find them notably at St. Olave Hart Street and at St. Mary at Hill. The gateway is 17th century.
I've never proved this, and I don't think anyone can prove it, but it is said that Hans Holbein the Younger, the German artist and printmaker, he died of an infection, possibly the plague, at the age of 45, sometime between making his last will and testament on the 7th of October 1543 at his home in Aldgate, and was buried on the 29th of November 1543, either here in St. Catherine Cree or at St. Andrew Undershaft. The site of his grave is unknown and probably was not marked. So,
since St. Andrew Undershaft is very close to here.
Is just down the road, yes. Yeah.
So somewhere around here.
Somewhere around here is where Hans Holbein is buried, but no one knows where.
No one can confirm it.
No. Behind the altar, there is a brass to Sir John Geyer.
Look at that. That's rather elaborate.
Now, Sir John was born, I think, in Plymouth. Was a merchant. He was Lord Mayor of London.
Yeah.
And this was his church when he was in London. He is famous certainly in the church, because in the early 1640s, he went out with a party of his friends, collaborators, whatever you like to call them, went out to Saudi Arabia. And he got separated from his friends. Dusk approached. He heard lions roaring and prowling around. So he carved out a sort of ellipse in the sand, prayed to God that he would be protected from the lions, lay down in the centre of this ellipse, presumably went to sleep. I'd be petrified. And in the morning, he found lion's paws had scraped the sand all the way round the outside of this ellipse. But God had protected him.
They didn't come in.
They didn't come in. They didn't maul him. And he said, as a result of God having done this, he would give money to the poor in this area, and also he required a sermon to be preached in this church every year from that date onwards, and it's called the Lion Sermon. And the preacher should be given, out of the money that he left, which of course has since been totally exhausted, should be given a bottle of Malmsey wine. And so we still give the preacher a bottle. I think it's bought from the local Marks and Spencers. I'm not quite sure what it is, but it's sort of red wine or the equivalent.
I'm sure the preacher's delighted, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so what's the is there a theme to the sermons, do you know?
The theme is being in the lion's den. And there's been an incredible range of people who have presented the lion's sermon, including one who's got his photo up in the vestry, and that's Terry Waite.
Oh,
he preached in, I think, 1993, after his time in Lebanon, I think.
And it's still going on.
And it still goes every year. I think it's the 360 something or other. But
when is it, roughly?
It's around the 16th of October. And his family still come. Some come from Australia, some come from the United States, to the Lion's Sermon. And invariably they read the two lessons. One is usually from Daniel in the Lion's Den, and the other is a New Testament reading. But
nice.
And that still continues to this day.
So this incredible moment in this man's life has sparked off this tradition.
Yeah, and when he was after he was Lord Mayor of London, he and a number of other sort of fairly senior people in the City of London were incarcerated in the Tower for refusing to do something that Charles the King wanted them to do. In there. And I think he was in there for 6 months and then was let out. He died, I think, in 1649.
And it says on the 20th of July, 1649, there you go.
Yep.
He was buried in a vault
his vault
church.
Is under the altar here somewhere, we believe.
So he's here.
There
you go, Mr. Geyer.
Sir John Geyer.
Now, while we're standing at the altar and we're looking to the west, the main door, above the door is a rather impressive-looking organ, which on coming in
you can't
appreciate.
Yeah.
I
think it was purchased in the 1660s, 1670s.
Yeah.
And it was played by Handel and Purcell.
Beautiful, beautiful organ. With the two cherubs at the top. Or four cherubs, actually, holding their little trumpets.
This is an extract from what's called the vestry minutes. 30th of September, 1685, ordered that there shall be a gallery and an organ built and set up at the west end of the church. And then, this was in November, agreement with Mr. Smith, the organ maker, for making the organ and case was this day read and ordered to be signed and sealed by Mr. Churchwarden Cox.
So Father Smith. He was the big organ.
And September 1686, the organ being now finished, it is ordered that Mr. Joseph Cox do procure Mr. Purcell, Mr. Barkwell and Mr. Moss, masters of music, and Mr. White, organ maker, or such other competent judges in music as may be prevailed with, to be at the church on Thursday next, the 30th of this instant September, about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, to give their judgments upon the organ.
They came to listen to it. Because it's really beautiful.
It is.
It's sort of
dark. It's been restored two or three times.
I mean, it's beautiful, dark, stained wood, which probably the Victorians did, actually. But with those very beautifully polished brass, I'm assuming brass pipes.
Yes, I don't know.
And a small keyboard.
They might be
beautiful.
Wood, actually. Wood with painted gold.
Oh, really? Lovely.
You
know, it stands alone over that main door. And I noticed from the outside, there's a What was a window that's been boarded up? So I guess when the organ was put in, they boarded up. Yeah,
yeah.
That was the end of the window.
Yep.
I think one of the most important things on the outside is an interesting 17th century sundial, which is divided into Babylonian hours and makes it virtually impossible for anyone to read these days, but it is on the south wall of the church, facing into Leadenhall.
If you were to describe the church, the look of it, how would you describe it?
I would describe it as a very traditional church with two aisles and a central nave. But it is undivided, only divided by the columns. And also the chancel is slightly raised, but not much. So it is very much a united church. It's a unified church. It's a church that shows itself to you immediately as you come in.
I mean, when you come in, obviously you can't miss the Catherine Wheel window, which is believed to have been similar to a window in the old St. Paul's Cathedral, one of the sort of circular windows in the old St. Paul's.
Is it that window over there? There's some story about a window that went missing and was found.
It is that one.
Can you tell me about that window, what it shows and what the story is behind it?
Yeah, I certainly can. It's the memorial window to Lindsay Smith, sometimes referred to as the Lost Window.
Right.
And Lindsay Smith was a church warden here, and he died in 1915. The windows depict, or that window depicts St. Andrew, St. George and St. Patrick. There was significant dry rot, something during the war, or just after the war, in the ceilings. And the church came very close to closure. And in the late 1950s, the diocese decided that it had to close. But the Industrial Christian Fellowship came along and said, we'll stump up the money to renew the roof, provided we can use it as our offices. I mean, that window went missing around about the time of the late 1950s when they were sort of refurbishing the church, effectively.
Yeah.
So there were offices built around the south wall and the north wall, and that's where you can see the discoloration.
Yes, you can, clearly.
Still there. And they occupied St. Catherine Cree until the late 1990s. And then when the last rector came, he decided to demolish, quite sensibly, all the offices. And it was found on the roof of one of these offices. They found 75% of the window. About, 10, 12 feet high.
So somebody at some point just taken the
taken the window out, and that was reinstated. There's a body called the Friends of St. Catherine Cree who gave the money for that window to be put back in.
Given that you mentioned that offices were here, had you not pointed that out, I wouldn't have noticed. But it is actually very clear.
It's very clear when you know.
When you know.
Yeah.
Because even the gravestones are sort of discoloured at certain points where they clearly had walls or partitions.
Yeah.
And the windows as well, they're blue at the top and white at the bottom with a kind of funny mark on them all the way around. Isn't that extraordinary? Even with a sort of ledge there where they must have put those roofs.
Yeah.
How strange. Well, I'm glad you pointed that out because you wouldn't have noticed otherwise. There's another noticeable window here, which looks more modern and brighter in its colours.
It is, and it's quite an important window. It's called the Lancastria window, and it's in memory of the 4,000 plus serving officers who were killed off Saint Nazaire when two German torpedoes or dive bombers dropped torpedoes on the Her Majesty's troop ship Lancastria in 1940. It was so horrendous that Winston Churchill covered it up. He wouldn't let it be known for some weeks. And I think it was published in a New York newspaper, and he couldn't deny it.
Word got out. And the model of the ship underneath that window, is that the Lancastria?
That is the Lancastria. The painting is of the Lancastria. And the bell is. The bell doesn't have the name Lancastria on it because it was the ship was originally a Cunard Steamship Company liner. It was launched in 1920 as the Tyrrhenia. And the bell's got Tyrrhenia on it. And they recovered that from the wreck on the seabed. They obviously didn't bring any of the bodies up. It's a grave off Saint-Nazaire. And all the ships that helped try and rescue those on board are on that board, are listed on the board, something like 17 or 18 ships.
Lancastria.
My uncle was 19 and he was on the Lancastria, Royal Artillery gunner, and he was called up when he was 18 and he was immediately sent to France, and after the fall of Dunkirk they were sent up to Saint-Nazaire because in effect they had to outrun the Germans, so that was the only way they could go. And the Lancastria and the RNSA were requisitioned from Cunard and sent to Saint-Nazaire. And because she was a liner, she was a huge thing, they had to ferry people out in small boats onto the Lancastria. Yeah. Well, the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, started to bomb, and they bombed for 3.5 hours. The bridge of the RNSA was blown to smithereens. She was on fire, listing. They started transferring people from the RNSA to the Lancastria. I had one survivor who started off on the RNSA, got on the Lancastria, taken on to the Lancastria. When that was hit, he went back on the RNSA. And he said to me, "I'm flying to the annual memorial service in France." He said, "I don't go by sea." Several of the survivors said the plane came in very low. It allegedly took the aerial off the top mast off the bridge, and a bomb fell between the forward hold and the funnel, went straight down the engine room, blew the engine room to smithereens. And several of the survivors told the story. They stood on the ship and she started listing heavily, and they said, "Oh my God, we've had it, she's going to sink." And then all of a sudden she levelled up. And they thought, "We've got away with this." I don't know how, but we've got away with this. She's levelled up. And then she started to roll the other way. And that was it. You couldn't hold her. She went. And she turned over on so that the hull was
upside down.
She was completely upside down. And one very brave Cunard boiler man, who wasn't a soldier, he worked for Cunard. And he led people that were in the hold through the ship, opened the hatch in the hull and got them out onto the hull of the ship.
So he knew his way
around. And I have a photograph. I have photographs of these men sitting on the hull of the Lancastria, taken by a man who was on HMS Highlander, who was sent out to rescue them. But the 4,500 is known now to be a conservative estimate. It was somewhere between 6,500 and 7,000 people. Okay. My uncle was on her. He was drowned. He'd sent his mother a telegram which said, "All right, on a ship." And she said, "Well, that's helpful." And then they sent him a message saying, "War Office, we regret to inform you that your son is missing, presumed dead in France." And he was washed up about 20 miles up the coast. And the resistance took these seven bodies, and they buried these seven bodies at the back of the church because the resistance were terrified that the SS were digging the bodies up to get their information. Our former president was a 17-year-old then, and he and his father and his fiancée used to go out. They were the only, because they ran the lifeboat, they were the only ones that the Germans would give a permit to. So they used to go out and take the bodies out of the sea. And he said by July you had to roll the bodies into the boat, because if you tried to lift them, bits of the body would come away in your hand. He would then run the boat into the beach at Nabul, drop the bodies on the beach, the resistance would nip out, take the body, take them away and bury them.
Do you mind telling me your name and your connection with...
Martin Coops. My father was in the Royal Engineers, attached to the RAF, walked from Epinay to Saint-Nazaire, told me very, very little about what happened, though I know he was always traumatised by it. His brother told me the story of him putting the wounded men onto the boat before himself. So he put his men before himself and then didn't know what happened to them. He made sure that they got off before he did, and he put them on the Lancaster, and he never forgave himself.
So it's been his mind all the time.
Yeah. And we retraced his footsteps in 95, and not once did we talk about anything that happened.
Yeah, it was too much for him to bear.
Yeah. He was 22 years old. Cliff Coops, his name was. Never talked about any of his war experiences. Was very sanguine. 17th of June 1940, 2 weeks after Dunkirk.
Well, thank you for sharing. It's terribly sad.
Pleasure. I still find it, as you can tell, really difficult.